All right, everybody, let's turn to Hebrews chapter 1. Starting a new series today. This will take a little while. Figured I'd go with the two most important books in the New Testament, do a series through Romans, and then why not do a series through Hebrews? Who knows how long this will take, but... And there's a lot of good stuff in this book. So it's interesting. I just got done writing the script for the next episode of the podcast. And it just so happens. I'm doing the canon of the general epistles. So that's Hebrews, James, 1st, 2nd Peter, and Jude. And normally my outlines for an episode are about 6 or 7 pages long. Sometimes they're longer. But this one is 10 pages just on the book of Hebrews, because the book of Hebrews was a little bit of a controversial book in the early church as to its acceptance. And so I wanted to make sure, because it's such an important book, I wanted to make sure that I hit it from all angles, really well to show why it was accepted into the canon. Because if you notice, it's anonymous. So the question really boils down to, who wrote this thing? And that was really why it wasn't accepted in parts of the church for a little bit of time. So I'm not going to get into all that stuff because, again, I'll get into that in the podcast episode. But I wanted to start off by discussing, authorship, look at the themes of the book and look at the outline of the book and kind of how the concepts, flow together and what the writer is trying to get across. So the book of Hebrews seems to have been written before 70 AD because he's writing to Jewish Christians who seem to be contemplating leaving Christianity and going back to Judaism. Because the whole concept is that it talks about the superiority of Christ and how he's better and over everything. So all the things in the Old Testament. So trying to warn them not to go back. So possibly, early 60s to mid 60s is when people have a tendency to think that this was written, possibly even a little bit earlier. Now, the question that, and I figured we'd deal with it first, who wrote the book? Like I said, it's anonymous, so it's impossible to know who actually wrote it. But I think that there's some really good evidence if we take a look at it as to where this might have come from. So various theories have been floated, some ancient, some more modern. Paul, Barnabas, Luke are the ancient ones. Apollos is a modern thought process of the authorship of the book. And, so there's all of those things to kind of go into it. So I put a lot of weight on what the early church writers have a tendency to say. And the reason is because they're so close to the time, right? I mean, when you look at some of these guys living about or writing about 100 years, maybe 125 years after, when it was supposedly written, I think they might have a little bit more evidence than somebody who lived 2,000 years afterwards, right? I mean, because they're more closely associated with the writing time. So I'm just going to lay out a couple of these guys. So you have one from the late second century. He's quoted by Eusebius. His name is Pantaenus. I don't know what his name is. Pataenus. I'm not sure how you would pronounce it. Pataenus? I don't know. Anyway, he's quoted by Eusebius. A lot of you have probably heard of Eusebius. He was a church historian, really involved in a lot of the councils, the ecumenical councils like Nicaea and Constantinople. And he wrote prodigiously. So we have a lot of his stuff. And he has been able to preserve some of the more ancient church history writers, the early church writers, that their writings haven't survived. A lot of it we know from him, where he quotes them because he had access to their writings, but they were disappeared after the scene on that. So he quotes this. He says that Paul wrote it in Hebrew And then it was translated by Luke for Greek audiences. Now, there's another book in the New Testament that ancient church history states was written in Hebrew, and that's the Gospel of Matthew. Papias, who was an early church writer, again, preserved in Eusebius, says that it was written in Hebrew originally and then translated into Greek. Now, the interesting thing is there's no Hebrew copies of Matthew. There's no Hebrew copies of Hebrews. Now, it does kind of make sense, though. If someone were writing to the Hebrews, it wouldn't be out of the question for it to be written in Hebrew / Aramaic originally. Wouldn't be out of the question. And if, let's say, it was written in about 60 or 65, somewhere in that time frame, and it was really circulated around Jerusalem and Judah and maybe Galilee, and then the destruction of Jerusalem happens just a few years later, maybe those copies were destroyed. Maybe they were burned. Maybe that's why they didn't survive. Plus, also, if it's written on papyrus, papyrus didn't survive in Israel. We have no papyri from Israel, you know, dating way back. Okay? Because it was too humid. Most of the papyrus that we find is found in Egypt or in places like the Dead Sea Scrolls, where it was really, really dry in the desert. It just didn't survive. It rotted. So that's why we don't have a lot of those old manuscripts. So he states Pauline authorship in Hebrew, Luke translated in Greek. Now you have, and so he was probably mid to late second century, so about 100 years after Paul died and would have written this, if that's the case. Clement of Alexandria, also quoted by Eusebius, also states Pauline authorship with Luke's style in his Greek translation. So there we have the two earliest witnesses of the authorship of Hebrews, both state Pauline authorship with Luke being the translator. Now, so this is going to be interesting because the question really boils down, so if Luke wrote it, there should be correlations between what he wrote in Luke and what he wrote in Acts versus what he wrote in Hebrews. And I won't get into it here, but I will in the podcast. We're recording on Tuesday. That'll come out the 1st of September. There are actually a lot of similarities between the writing style of Hebrews and the writing style of Luke and Acts. It's really interesting. A lot of the same Greek structure, a lot of the same grammar. Now, it is different because Luke and Acts are historical narratives. This is an epistle. It's a completely different style of writing, right? I mean, if you read like a historical narrative, it's just a very different style of writing versus an epistle. You're going to use different words, but a lot of the Greek grammar is very, very similar. As a matter of fact, Hebrews 1 through 4 is very similar to Luke chapter 1:1-4. And if you listen to that episode on that podcast, Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4 is like the most eloquent Greek in the New Testament. And Hebrews is right after it. It's like right on par with it because he uses the same kind of structure and style that he does in, or that's used in Luke chapter 1. So my opinion has kind of changed. I didn't really have a very strong opinion on this, but I'm really leaning towards this because it seems like the evidence is really in that. The only other one in the ancient times who had any kind of a mention, I believe Origen stated that it could have, and he's writing around 250, stating that the author's uncertain. It definitely has Pauline theology in it, but it was probably Barnabas who wrote it. And even all the modern scholars, even progressive scholars, liberal scholars, and conservative scholars state it has a lot of Pauline theology in it. So that's why Paul has been the one circulated. However, there's some clues in the book that let us know it might not have been Paul. It's specifically chapter 2 in verse 3, where he says, "After it was at first spoken through the Lord, it was confirmed to us by those who heard. God also testifying with them, both by signs and wonders and by various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will." Paul, you know, even though he didn't walk with Christ, he did receive the revelation directly from Christ and was able to hear the gospel. So that's why Paul definitely did not write this. I will say that. It doesn't bear any of his style. It's not his Greek. It's not his style of writing. But it does bear a lot of Pauline ideas. So whoever wrote it would have been very, very familiar with Paul and was probably a traveling companion or a disciple of Paul. So that really leaves like three people. It would leave guys like Luke, maybe Silas, but Silas's name hasn't been brought out as an author, Barnabas and Apollos, right? But because we don't know how Barnabas wrote, we don't know how Apollos wrote, right? And like I said, Apollos is a modern idea. None of the ancient guys ever floated him. I have a tendency to think that my opinion's kind of shifted to where I think this is probably Luke's handiwork. Okay. I could be 1,000% wrong on that. Again, it's anonymous. That's the problem with the book and why some churches didn't accept it. So, like I said, the Greek style is different. There's no personal greeting or identification of the author. Paul always did that, right? He always introduced himself. That's about all I'll talk about with the authorship at this particular time. But again, you know, we're going to go into a lot more detail on the podcast. So, themes of the book. And I'm just going to hit a couple of themes, and then we're going to go over the book from start to finish and just hit the flow of thought through the book, because I think that's really important. Because sometimes when we get into a book and we're preaching verse by verse and we're you know, narrowing down like with a microscope, sometimes it's hard to take a step back and say, okay, well, how does this fit into the whole structure of everything, right? How does it fit into the whole theme of the book? So I think it's good to hit all of the major themes up front and then dive in and then take a step back while we're diving in and say, okay, now this is how it fits. Remember when we talked about this and talk about how it fits in. So obviously what we have in Hebrews chapter 1, Christ's superiority over the angels, right? It's just his superiority over any of the angels all through chapter 1. Chapter 3, he talks about the superiority of him over Moses. And in the middle of that, though, we get this concept of how Jesus, even though he's superior over the angels, did briefly become humbled and take on the form of a human. Now, that's going to set the stage for the types of things that are talked about in chapter 4, where his superiority over the Levitical priesthood. That actually covers chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6, and chapter 7. So I find it interesting that when we look at this, we see a large chunk of the book is taken up with the concept of Christ's superiority over the Levitical priesthood and how the Levitical priesthood absolutely and utterly failed compared to Christ. But the thing that I find really interesting is how people think that the Levitical priesthood is going to be reestablished and that it's going to have any bearing whatsoever. You know, Jesus is the high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. And that priesthood far surpasses anything from the old, which means the high priesthood of Jesus far surpasses the high priesthood of the Old Testament. And it also means our priesthood far surpasses the priesthood of those in the Old Testament. So why would God take a new system that's far superior and then reinstitute one that failed and wasn't good? But that's the dispensational mindset. That's the premillennial mindset, right? And all these premillennials think that Jesus is going to reestablish a priesthood that he abolished, reinstitute animal sacrifices, and that he's going to be okay with that. He's going to think that's a great idea. It's like all these Christians, did you guys see the sacrifice that took place over in Israel about, I think it was 2 months ago, where they did a red heifer sacrifice? Now, it was disqualified because it had two black hairs. Now, what the red heifer sacrifice is, the last time it happened was for the dedication of the temple. That's what it's used. That's what it's used for. So all these dispensational folks are going nuts over the fact that they're doing a dry run on getting the things necessary to sanctify the temple, the third temple. Because, and that God is directing this process. That God is directing the process and he's happy with the process. How in the world can God look at any animal sacrifice, anything that the Jewish people are doing outside the Messiah, and look on that with pleasure? Boggles my mind. But they think that this is what God's all into and interested in. Not to mention, according to Ezra chapter 2, verses, 59 through 62, they have to be able to show direct genealogical descent all the way to Levi and to the sons of Aaron to be able to prove that they're a priest. And if they can't prove it, they're disqualified. And nobody can do that. The genealogies are lost. Even they'll admit that. Their genealogies only go back a few hundred years. So there's no way they can do it. It's interesting, I think. So after he gets done with the priesthood, he talks about the superiority of the new covenant in chapter 8, the fulfillment of the old covenant in chapter 10, the sacrifice that was offered in chapter 9. And then we get into the application of these things. And now, after we talk about the failure of the priesthood, the failure of the old covenant, superiority of the new covenant, now we talk about how these Old Testament folks were justified. And we get to chapter 11. How are they all justified? By faith. By faith. And then in chapter 12, he uses them as an example, and then Christ, our high priest, as our example. And then he lets us know in chapter 12, if you're a son, you're going to be disciplined. Because remember what happened to the Jewish Christians. Now he says a little bit later, or a little bit earlier in the book, he says, you joyfully accepted the seizure of your property. Because that's what happened when you were a Jew and became a Christian. Your property was confiscated. You lost your job. In many cases, they'd have a funeral for you. You're dead. That's why the church had to step in and take care of people. Because they didn't have the ability to do that. They couldn't work. See, what Paul, or whoever's writing it, Luke, whoever, is trying to say, this is discipline. God scourges every son whom he receives. Jesus, he said it earlier, chapter 5, verse 8, Jesus learned obedience through suffering. So how in the world do we think we're going to do it? There's no way we're going to learn any obedience without suffering. It's not possible. Because discipline's not joyful. Think about the things that we do to build discipline, to build faith, to build our perseverance, how God takes us through situations. If everything was good, daisies and rainbows, man, we wouldn't be very strong, would we? As soon as the sun beats down, we'd wither up. See, what God's trying to get across is this. God's trying to get across, if my son had to learn obedience through suffering, that's how you're going to learn it. That's what Christianity is. Now, there's a lot of joy. There's a lot of happiness. There's a lot of peace. Right? But there's suffering. And that's not popular today, but it is the way that it is. And then, of course, we have warnings and exhortations all through the book. Chapter 2 warns against how the people of Israel were, or chapter 3 warns against how the people of Israel were. Chapter 6, we have the warning against falling away. Chapter 10, we also have the warning against forsaking the assembly, making sure we're still encouraging each other. So all of that is all in there. All right, so Now, let's go to chapter 1, and I want to walk through the actual flow of the book more specifically so that we can have a good understanding of what we're talking about. So again, in chapters 1, you know, verses 1 through 4, we have a really cool picture of an introduction. And one of the most powerful things in this introduction, I think, is the identification of the last days. The writer of Hebrews is letting us know that they were in the last days back then. And so when we think of last days, we think of, oh man, that means it's just about to end. Well, what they had the concept of the last day and what God concept of the last day is, this is the last age. So we had the early age, Genesis, you know, the age before the flood. That's the time, you know, David, you're talking about how God didn't give us any information about those guys. And obviously, that's on purpose, right? But man, my curious nature, I really would like to know more about the technology than what they knew before the flood. Because we don't have access to any of that stuff. Now, think about this. If you go back and look, is Genesis History? Is that the name of the series? Is Genesis History? And you watch that movie, and the very first scene, they open up on the Grand Canyon, right? And they look at all those layers, and they tell you how the Grand Canyon formed at the flood. Think about how deep that is, right? Think about all the layers of sediment that are on top of that. So my opinion is this. I've got an opinion on this that, again, I always like to say when I'm really talking about opinion. I think the entire pre-flood world was completely and utterly destroyed, and we don't see any of it. Because it's all buried under all of this sediment. I mean, the oil that we have are those people and dinosaurs and vegetation. That's what you put in your... We run our vehicles on dinosaur and human carcasses and plant matter. So we can't see any of that stuff. They found some artifacts from that time frame in coal seams, but most of it is completely and utterly destroyed. Because I think God wanted all of it wiped out. I also think, if that's the case, that God performed another miracle after the waters receded in causing vegetation to sprout up fast and quickly. Because if you think about it, Noah had branches of an olive tree with fruit on it, right? How could that have grown that fast and recovered that quickly? Couldn't have. So I personally think that there was a miracle after the flood that caused all of the plants and everything to regenerate very, very, very quickly. So just my opinion. I could be completely wrong, but if the Grand Canyon is any indication, man, there's hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of feet of sediment that covered the whole earth after the flood. So, well, maybe not always, because you've got fossils that are buried and, you know, sometimes not too deep of an area. But anyway, I still think the force of it would have destroyed anything from before that. So this concept of the last day is talking about the last age that we're in, the church age. Because this is the last age. These are the last days. There's nothing coming after this except the second coming. So that's why God can say these are the last days, even though they've lasted for 2,000 years. Right? And then, like we said, he talks about the superiority over the angels. And that goes through all the rest of chapter 1. And he brings up something really interesting at the end of chapter 1. That's where we find out that angels are ministering spirits sent out to render service for the sake of those who will inherit salvation. That should make us feel pretty good. You know, that not only does God living in us to strengthen us, we have angels to help us in the time of need. Now, I think it would be really cool, because it seems like angels have a role in shepherding us to our final destination after death. It seems like that's the case with looking at the rich man and Lazarus. Okay, so I could be wrong, but I think that might be the case. I'm kind of hoping that the angel that does that for me is the one that's kind of sent out to that was sent out to render service for me. And the reason for that is, number one, I'd like to meet him. And number two, I'd like to apologize for all the problems that I gave him over the years of me being stubborn and not getting things through my thick head. Because I'm sure I have exasperated the Lord at times, and I'm pretty sure I've exasperated whatever angels have been sent out to render service for my sake, who might be watching out for me and ministering to me. So I would like to apologize on my way to see the Lord. And then in chapter 2, we get this concept about subjection. How the earth was subjected to humanity, but specifically Christ being the ruler of all things. And then even Christ, though, became humbled himself, became lower than the angels. You couple this over with Philippians chapter 2, and you get a really great concept of what the incarnation was. And then in chapter 2, verse 14, it talks about how, and this is a really important passage, that Jesus had the same flesh and blood that we have. It was no different. So this is a tremendous counter-argument to Gnosticism that's being laid out here before Gnosticism really became a big deal. So God's laying all this out for us very importantly. Then chapter 3, we get into the concept of the high priesthood of Christ, that he's going to spend the next time on going through all the way to chapter 7. And he warns us. And so the other thing he's talking about is how Jesus is superior to Moses, right? So look at verse 5 or verse 4. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all his house as a servant, for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken of later. But Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are, if we hold fast our confidence and boast of our hope firm until the end. See, he's letting us know that what the writer of Hebrews is really doing in this whole book, pulling out all of the types in the Old Testament and showing how they pointed the way to Christ and to the new covenant, but also how they utterly failed, and that the fulfillment comes in the new. So as a result of that, he talks about Moses and how Moses was great, right? But he also says there in verse 12, you know, take care, brethren, that there not be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart. In other words, those going back to Moses. Moses told people, today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts as when they provoked me. Right? So he's telling us, don't follow the example of the people at the time of Moses, but instead be faithful. Chapter 4, we get into the concept of the rest and how Joshua wasn't able to give them rest. Wasn't that the point of them going into the promised land? But that wasn't the rest God was really getting at. See, the rest that God's really getting at is something that is a new covenant reality, not something from the old. So that's why we don't keep the Sabbath day in the new covenant, because the Sabbath has been redefined for us, because the Sabbath in the Old Testament was the type. God doesn't necessarily care if you take a break on Saturday, on the seventh day. He doesn't really care, because that rest was pointing to something else, a rest that we now enjoy and will enjoy as well. Then he makes a bridge in verse 14 of chapter 4, where he says, therefore, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. So we have this high priest, and now he's setting up the stage for who this high priest is, what he has done, and how he operates. So I won't dive into too much of chapters 5, 6, and 7. Suffice it to say that what we're dealing with here is the change of law that takes place, how the priesthood of the Levites was just failing in every single way, and how the priesthood of Christ is just way more important, because here we have a perfect, undefiled high priest who has become such, not on the basis of law, but on the basis of an indestructible life. And that was not the basis of the old covenant priesthood in any way, shape, or form. So since there's a change of law, now in chapter 8, he's going to talk about what that change of law is. And now he's going to spend that time talking about a new covenant. And he spends most of the chapter talking about a quote from Jeremiah 31, starting in verse 31, laying aside the old covenant and establishing the new. And he ends chapter 8 with a powerful verse in verse 13, where he says, when he set a new covenant, he has made the first obsolete. But whatever is becoming obsolete is growing old and ready to disappear. The disappearing took place in 70 AD when the temple was destroyed. I don't care what anybody says. A Jew cannot truly practice Old Testament Judaism without the temple, without sacrifices. It cannot be done. There is no basis for atonement, forgiveness, or anything. Although I've heard some rabbis recently talk about how substitutionary atonement doesn't exist in the Torah, doesn't exist in the law, doesn't exist in Judaism. And I'm just wondering what book in the world they're reading, because the entirety of Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, laying out the sacrifices, is all about substitutionary atonement. The whole thing. But since you haven't been able to practice it for 2,000 years, you got to come up with something, right? So that's what they come up with. So in chapter 9, he talks about some really important aspects of the Old and New Covenant, drawing allusions from the Old Covenant to the New Covenant. And then another thing that's really interesting, and we use this quite a bit as well, verses 16 and 17, talks about when a covenant is valid. Covenant is valid only when someone dies. And that lets us know specifically when the new covenant began. The new covenant began at Jesus' death. The terms weren't laid out until the day of Pentecost, but the old covenant ended when Jesus died. And God put an exclamation on that by ripping the veil from top to bottom. Now, I've read different reports that veil was made of really thick camel's hair and was probably around 6 inches thick. 6 inches thick. How do you rip something like that from the top to the bottom accidentally? You don't. It was ripped absolutely on purpose. You know what they saw when they looked in there? Mark talked about this a little bit, but there's no ark in there. The ark was gone since the first destruction of Jerusalem in 586. See, nothing. So it makes you wonder, what in the world were the priests sprinkling the blood on? Were they just sprinkling it into the air? It's very interesting to think about. See, but what God was letting us know is that he's not there anymore. He was there, even though there was no ark, which lets us know the ark wasn't, necessary. But when that veil split, there was nothing back there anymore. Then in chapter 10, he really, really focuses on how the sacrifice of Christ surpasses all of the other sacrifices and how it really boils down to the clean conscience that we have in Christ. Because that's how you know sins are truly forgiven. All right, chapters 11 and 12, we won't dive too much into this. But this, in my opinion, is where he really focuses on faith, but also the land promise. This is where he really talks about what was the underlying concept behind the land promise. Was it the physical land of Israel? No, that's not what the patriarchs understood. The patriarchs understood that they were looking for a city whose architect and builder is God. They were looking for a heavenly city. That's what they truly understood. And so then in chapter 12, he discusses very specifically, starting in verse 18, that their birthright, well, he talks about birthright a little bit before that. Their birthright wasn't some physical mountain on the Arabian Peninsula. Their birthright was the heavenly Jerusalem. Because that's the fulfillment of what Abraham and the patriarchs were looking for. So notice he deals with the priesthood, he deals with the covenant, he deals with the sacrifices, he deals with the land. Very specifically. And then in chapter 3 or 13, he wraps the book up and he talks about essentially, look, you guys got it tough. I know that. But, you know, we need to go outside the camp. That's a really important exhortation for these folks. Jesus suffered outside the walls of Jerusalem, physical Jerusalem. They need to recognize that even as Jewish Christians, they're outside the camp. That's where you dwell. You're not a part. Your first allegiance is not to Israel anymore. Your first allegiance is to spiritual Israel, the true Israel of God. And that's where he ends the book, with that type of an exhortation. You know, the bottom line with all of this, he was saying it to the Jews, he's saying it to us. We can't have this world in Christ at the same time. It's not possible. Doesn't mean we don't have things in this world that we, you know, we have homes, we have things, and they're there for us to enjoy. Don't get me wrong. But we can't be of the world. We can't seek after those things as our primary focus of life. That's really not what he's wanting us to do. Our focus needs to be the same as the patriarchs. A city whose architect and builder is God, and a heavenly city that we now dwell in. They didn't dwell in it. We do. And that's outside the camp. That's outside the camp of this world. And we need to be okay with that. Because the world's going to persecute us just like it persecuted him. All who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. So the more we know that and expect that, less it's going to take us by surprise, and the more we'll be able to rejoice in it, because we know if that's how Jesus learned obedience, that's how we're going to learn obedience too. And that should make us happy, because that's what we want. We want to be conformed to the image of Christ, because man, what a privilege that is. All right, we're going to stop there. Anybody got questions or comments? And we'll dive into chapter 1, verse 1 next week.
So if any, 60 AD?
So yeah.
So yep. Fitting to the Jews and so logical. How could you deny it?
Yep.
How could John Hagee, or somebody like that, supposedly educated, get up there and preach what they preach? And it's simple, little redneck Barry can understand this thing, see it very clearly. I mean, I don't.
It's a crazy thing, because the book of Hebrews completely and utterly destroys all dispensational theology. It wipes it off the map. So I agree. I don't understand how. Well, they just ignore the book.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
They have to.
Yes.
So, yeah.
A little bit puzzling why we don't have an author. I mean, the Holy Spirit writes, and everything's inspired. The Word of God is inspired. And a little bit puzzling why we do not have that. But I guess some, you know, you'll know everything that Brother Dave said.
Yeah.
The book's too powerful. Dude. You know, it's, I mean, it's awesome. Book.
See, and that's the thing. So I didn't really talk about this, but the Eastern Church, so the church in the eastern part of the Roman Empire, Syria, Jerusalem, Alexandria was considered the Eastern Church. all of these people, when we start going back, if you listen to the podcast episode when it comes out in September, the quotes from the book of Hebrews started very quickly. They started in like the tail end of the first century. So the Eastern Church accepted the book of Hebrews right out of the gate. The Western Church, Rome, struggled with it a little bit. Number one, it's written to Hebrews. We're Gentiles over here. You know, they didn't quite see how that fit in and the anonymity of it. But they, the one thing that they saw was that it was absolutely apostolic in content. Absolutely apostolic. In other words, there was authority behind the book. And that's how the canon was done. The church didn't create or accept the canon. They recognized the books that were inspired and that had apostolic authority. And that's why I put a lot of weight on the Eastern churches who accepted it right away, because again, they're closer to the source and they had no qualms with it whatsoever. So the majority of the church accepted it, except for some of those guys out west. Then, but by the third century, or actually by the middle of the second century, they're starting to get on board. And by the third century, they're completely on board. So yeah, it wasn't as controversial as people like to make it out to be, but the anonymity didn't really help. And I also think the anonymity, though, was on purpose, because if this is Paul, if he's the apostle to the Gentiles, he had some troubled history with a lot of the Jewish Christians, it makes sense if his name wasn't on it, if that was the intended audience, and that Luke would have been the one to actually write it. So, and interpret and put his style over it. So I don't know how that works, but that's how they viewed it in the early church. And it seems to make sense because, like I said, there's a lot of connections between Luke and Acts and Hebrews. Anybody else have any comments or questions? No? Okay. Barry, you want to close us out in prayer, please?